I've worked my whole life kind of pushing and just grinding and trying to get to that next level for myself. And I just feel like I would have told myself, you know, just enjoy it while you're there.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Partners in Time. And today I'm especially excited. It's my dear friend and founder of Period Correct, Brian J. Calvero, who's joining us today. You may remember Brian actually from the 3705 campaign. I think we had a fantastic, amusing and deliberation session over the 190 Evo and the merits and benefits of a 90s classic form follows function box design that has inspired both the tool watch that is the 3705 and also many of the classic performance cars of those era, including of course the absolute classic Evo. And I'm delighted to have you with us today, Brian. How are you?
Hey, Chris, it's such a pleasure to be here. I'm quite honored to kind of be on your podcast here, and it's just
a
blessing,
man. On my
very
small podcast.
I love it. No, I love it. I'm very honored. I'm like blown away to just be a guest here.
So now we've actually just seen, you're actually in Paul Ripke's studio down in Newport Beach. So describe a little bit to us, because Paul's got a much bigger podcast than you and I have. But what's the setup like? Is that all pro down at Paul's place?
Oh, he's got it dialed in. And his location, I mean, come on, I kind of drive down this road on PCH literally maybe 3-4 days a week. So he's in paradise here, but studio is set up proper. He has the coffee machine here and just is dialed.
I know that's what happens when you've successfully worked for 6 or 8 years in Formula One, you know, with some luxury clients like IWC on the side, and then you're sorted.
Right. I can imagine.
How's things over there at the moment? How are you doing?
Everything's good, you know, just staying busy, you know, multiple projects going on, which I'm looking forward to share with you guys. So, yeah, I mean, playing part-time interior designer and kind of, you know, we got a new store opening. So it's taken a bunch of our time in LA, which I'm proud to kind of announce in the Playa Vista area. So,
oh, cool.
Pretty exciting.
Can't wait to see that. Can't wait to see that. But let's maybe give our listeners a little bit of an intro for those who don't know you and maybe haven't seen the 3705 campaign. You are, of course, you know, a very, very design conscious and automotive culture legend in the SoCal area. And of course, the founder of Period Correct. But tell us a little bit about your story, maybe.
Yeah. So again, I'm Brian J. Calvero. I mean, I've been kind of born, raised here in California, you know, out of LA, grew up here and just, you know, grew up around, you know, just the lifestyle, the culture that California's given, from skateboarding to, you know, biking and, you know, the whole culture of street fashion and working in that industry. But yeah, I'm the creative director and kind of founder of Period Correct. And, you know, it was a brand that basically is based around my personal passion. So I kind of operate in those kind of terms. I'm looking, you know, I basically am building a brand that I've been just passionate about. And that's kind of what I do here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And give us a bit of a flavor for those of us who are not sort of from California, Southern California, the importance of car culture when it comes to, you know, really determining a style, fashion, everything around a way of living, and how all this comes together with the other. I mean, you beautifully combine it with your mid-century love of furniture and architecture and all the rest of it. But just give us a flavor on just how big an influence in sort of California that type of cultural background actually has.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I literally kind of put myself through kind of what you said there with the mid-century modernism affair. I've almost read every single book out there, and, you know, the case study program, which is a big program here in California, you know, several architects that had this program out here influenced me in every way, and kind of that indoor outdoor living, you know, the weather here is amazing. So kind of their architecture being inside, feeling like you're outside. When you're outside, you're inside. So that whole culture of just those influences is a big deal in my life. You know, yeah, I've collected furniture. I've worked for the Eames family for several years at the Eames house. Mm. You know, was looking forward to being an architect, but that didn't quite work out for me in that kind of vision there. But apparel was, you know, our way out. That was kind of me and my brother, who I credit so much, we always wanted to be different in our block, in our neighborhood. It was about being different than the next guy and being kind of original, or trying to, you know, have a trend that was different and trying to be against the trend. And, you know, I think California has a lot of that, where people are just trying to differentiate themselves. And I think that's what makes it great. There's a lot of subculture here, and I'm definitely a fan of that. But California has a lot to offer. I mean, you could, you know, there's guys that are just into road biking. There's guys that into cars. And when you talk about cars, I mean, you got Porsche guys, you got guys that only deal with English Ford and Lotus. And there's obviously American car culture here. So it's just a great melting pot of car culture and fashion. And I just feel like, you know, a lot of the people that I knew that were in New York and abroad and even in Europe, they moved to LA and they're setting their whole base here. And it's exciting to see what's happening in here.
Yeah, definitely. And I can totally identify with that, because literally, I think when it comes to the creative vibe and just the sort of the sheer energy that you find in that area at the moment, I think there's no place on earth that I personally find as inspiring as your patch of the world. And then that's why I used to come over quite frequently before we all got shut down by coronavirus. But it's quite amazing. And you're right. You know, it's funny you should mention, you know, you obviously wanted to be an architect, ended up in apparel. I always wanted to do apparel, ended up being an architect. So
let's trade,
definitely.
Seriously.
At least for a week or so. But I want to drill down a little bit into this concept of, you know, the concept of mobility and the concept of the love of cars that is often behind what many of the popular culture is actually driven by. And you know this much better than me, but it sort of goes back to the 50s and 60s, I guess, when California and the hot rod culture and all of that developed a particular take on this idea of American mobility. Where is that for you? Where's the cultural roots of what defines maybe that side of car culture in that area today?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think those early days paved the way. You would see there was road races, you know, all throughout kind of even the cities that we kind of dwell in today. Obviously, there's no longer races there, but, you know, there's at the, you know, different bases and there was races all through the streets. But you would see kind of early Porsches and early Ferraris racing Ciattas, and of course, Laguna Seca. You have, you know, Riverside Raceway. There was so much race history here. If you were to dive in and just see the car culture that that exists in those days, I mean, it was, you know, it was quite amazing to see what was there and how, you know, a lot of the cars that were racing in period, you know, people were driving them home and taking it from their home, going to the races, racing, and then driving home the same day in the same car. And tons of race history down here, which is definitely, you know, was a big thing. And you know, seeing that culture kind of now, you know, being, I want to say, you know, it's the background of every brand these days, right? They're using it as their prop, or it's in their line for the season. And it's quite, you know, before I started Period Correct, I mean, there wasn't really a brand based around automotive car culture, or maybe there was, but it was for like a car show, or, you know, it was for the track.
Yeah. Or accessory lines that use car branding just simply to, you know, and they weren't always the most fashionable ones either. And I remember, you know, you're probably familiar with the UK original historic TV format of Top Gear. Yep. And in those days, I think they had a drag race between some performance variants of some main premium German automakers that should not be named. And basically, I think the guys turned this whole thing into a joke by putting on all of the merch they've received from different car companies over the years. So you'd get these ridiculous sort of soft shell jackets with all the branding and Nürburgring all over it. And, you know, the sunglasses and the Bluetooth headset, like the works, like all of the stuff that you could see that was definitely no sense of style of fashion in any of that. And maybe that's also to do with some of these car companies obviously being based in southern Germany with sort of sandal socks and shorts and stuff like that, so it's not necessarily a style. So you've done the world a fantastic service by bringing this right into the heart of a sense of style and elegance and also quality, and talk a little bit about that, because I think you're quite particular about the material sourcing and craftsmanship of your clothes, right?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that. I mean, it was tough, you know, developing this brand. You know, I basically, to give you a backstory on that, you know, I had this concept in my head. And when I went to go visit Tokyo, Japan with my brother on a trip doing research for his brand, you know, I walked into this small shop, had an F40 in there, sitting in the lobby there. And he had a rack of kind of clothes there that was kind of race gear from some of his other track, merchandise. And he was pouring coffee. Mm. And I just had this idea when I was out there. But, you know, during that tour, we visited, you know, various shops and brands, and seeing the quality of what they were building out there, it just seemed like they were miles ahead, you know, in customer service and in production. I mean, it just didn't get better when we were out there. So I was highly influenced by those kind of standards, and you got to find a medium here, you know. I mean, obviously you can make the highest quality here and try to figure out the balance of making sure the price point fits the demographic you're targeting. Right. And that's difficult because, you know, you want to make a really great cut and sew piece if it's a jacket, you know, and then you figure out, hey, $500 or $600 jacket doesn't work for my customer. Mm. You get stunned. You're like, hey, hold on here, right? So you work with what you got. And when it came to choosing, you know, what bodies we were using for our printables and, you know, our cut and sew, we basically try to find a really good medium, you know, everything made here in the US as much as we could. And, you know, trying to just be in charge of, you know, all the production and the manufacturing, being hands-on with that. So I'd be there doing the creative direction. I have a great designer who works under me, who helps me put some of the graphic language on there from, you know, my inspirations. And then I'll go and manage the production. And we kind of work as a team. So we take great pride in that. And we try our best to give our customer kind of a product that, you know, that they would be proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can relate to that in a sense, because the only real sort of bit of apparel, a functional jacket that I've ever attempted was during a project back in, well, I think 2008, 2009, we were doing something called the IWC Collection. It was supposed to be an apparel and accessories range that illustrated all our different universes at IWC, you know, from the diving to the flying to the road racing and all the rest of it. And I got my mind set on creating an after diving jacket, which was basically sort of a soft shelly but still kind of waterproof jacket with a huge amount of insulation so that people would be warm after re-emerging from the ocean, as it were. And then you had basically, I wanted all sorts of functionality in there. I wanted a proper hood that was, you know, properly adapting to the face. I wanted kind of a watch window where you could strap the watch underneath the sleeve. And then there was like a bungee type tie thing that you could tighten that would actually lift the watch case up above the jacket sleeve so you could see the time clearly at all times. And by the time I was done with this pet project, basically finance came back to me and said, okay, if we're going to make this in a prototyping studio somewhere in Europe, you're going to be looking at a retail price of about $5,000 for this jacket. Is that okay? And I was like, oh, we're thinking more like 750 maybe. And you very quickly reached the limits of what is feasible in small quantities. And small quantity seems to be the absolute enemy of the apparel industry, right?
Exactly. And that's what happens when you let an architect design a jacket.
Yeah,
right?
Don't do that ever again. not a good idea.
It's
definitely
awesome.
Not.
So awesome.
No, and I remember, I mean, you know, Brian, we actually sort of met in not in a strange way, but in, I thought it was really entertaining because we basically I hadn't heard of you and you probably hadn't heard of me, I can only assume, until I was speaking on another podcast, a Hodinkee podcast, and somehow they got onto my Hot Wheels collecting passion in that podcast. I still don't know where they got that info from originally, but they pulled it out of the bag there and then, and they asked me on the spot whether there was a Holy Grail, a car that I was still looking for and I hadn't managed to find in my years of collecting. And because it was that sort of time, your period correct 190 Evo just popped into my head. And I said, well, that's definitely a car that is absolutely unique. How did that collaboration originally come about?
Yeah, you know, so previous to that collaboration, I was actually meeting with the Mattel group and Hot Wheels, and I think they had went through different kind of upper management there, but I was working with them early before any of those kind of collaborations kind of launched, even before you saw, you know, some of the early ones like Magnus or Rod or et cetera. Yeah. So I was talking to them about, hey, there's a culture here in the streetwear side or kind of lifestyle in the street fashion that I think could be cool for you guys. And at the same time, obviously, they heard of my brand and I was like meeting there for that particularly, but I was telling them there's this whole other world here. I think it would be great tie-in, you know, there's you guys, you know, they made a list of brands for them at the time, and you know, they asked me and they said, well, what car would you want to do? And I gave them a list and they told me, hey, well, let's get that going, and what's one of your favorites? And that popped up first. And yeah, and I had all these other cars lined up, but unfortunately, the guys that I recommended for them to work with chose those cars before I had a chance. So I was kind of.
Did you choose the BMW M1 as well?
I did. I had the M1. I had the M1 and the M3 first, and then.
Okay, we know where they went. Definitely.
Yeah, we know where they went. But great story going back, and I think people need to hear that. Of I was listening to that podcast live. On Hodinkee when you're on there. And when I heard you mention the brand, I was literally gassed. I was like, wait, I played, what did he say period correct? And then I was trailing back. And I mean, people need to know that, you know, we kind of met through that one subculture there. We're both into the Hot Wheels thing, and you flew out and we got to meet. I think we spent 5 or 6 hours that day talking about architecture, furniture,
despite the jet lag.
Cars. Exactly.
Half awake, we had a probably.
We had a pretty big meal right there by the Noguchi Garden. I think, you know, how small things, and I love that. And that's what I love about cars or watches. It's just the way it ties and brings people together. You would never guess, hey, why is Brian hanging out with this guy or that guy?
No, it's an instant connection, definitely.
I love that.
Funny thing is, by the way, the other day, you know, my family, obviously, especially at the weekends, they see me an awful lot in period correct stuff. And congratulations again on all your spring releases this year. Really, I mean, a fantastic job. And I love the quality and the fit of your clothes. Just fantastic.
I can only warmly
recommend it to everybody who hasn't discovered period correct, because it's literally, the sizing is so reliable. Everything washes beautifully and it's almost iron free. Okay, I'll stop advertising now, but you know, they often see me in your stuff. And the other day, my daughter actually said to me, Dad, why does it say period correct on your shirt? And I explained it to her, and almost like all at the same time, the whole rest of my family went, oh, that's what it means. I never understood it either. So even my wife was like, right, now I get it. So that needs to be, to non-car people, that needs to be explained a little bit. So next time I'll put the disclaimer on there. And obviously I love the fact that half of your stuff actually says engineering on somewhere, which obviously totally resonates with RWC and what we do. And I think this approach of this appreciation of form together with the love of mechanics and engineering is really where I think those worlds really connect. And I think that's also one of those moments where when we started talking about the 3705, which I believe you're wearing on your wrist right now at this moment, that's really where it all comes together. You know, that purity of form together with performance, with engineering. I mean, that's what makes us tick, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's exactly it. And I think with this, with the Tribute 3705, I mean, I think you guys absolutely nailed it for me. I mean, I am wearing it proudly this morning, and I can't take it off, I'll be honest, since I received it. But it's just proportioned perfectly. And looking down at it, it just, it does everything for me. It just feels like it's just well engineered, and I just feel, you know, it's just a really good feeling to see something. I feel like in 5, 10 years, 15, 20 years time, this watch is still going to be just as iconic as it was when you launched it. So you guys nailed it there. Talk about quality, engineering, precision, the apparel piece on my part. That's very minute compared to what you guys do at IWC. And I just love that. I love your brand. And genuinely, I think people affiliated with your brand, which is amazing, is, you know, just hearing the other podcasts, they're genuinely like a fan. It's not something where it's some paid kind of, you know, advertisement or them. They love the watch. And I just like that it's organic.
Yeah. And I think it's important nowadays. I do really think that all our customers are, you know, smart enough to spot just a simple commercial association when they see one. And I think our businesses are all about passion, and that's really what we're here for. And I think that's why the organic relationships just definitely work much, much better. And I do wonder sometimes, you know, when I look back at you know, discussing the 3705 and the Evo, but, you know, in many ways, and you had it just now when you did the big highlight on the Group B cars as well, a lot of these designs are very pure, very brutal, and very to the point, and very sort of unadulterated in a sense. And you can never imagine, and I see that in movies sometimes as well, like it feels like somebody sat down and created something start to finish, and it feels natural. It doesn't feel like there's been like a, you know, a communication committee around the table of 20 people saying, but we should also target this, you know, sub niche group, and we should make sure it does that. And, you know, and in the end, is design, is that kind of approach to design still possible even nowadays? Or do we live in a very different age where you've got this myriad of stakeholder influences that are kind of pulling in every direction? And how do you find that nowadays in design? Or is that really a thing that was so typical of that era of classic car and watch designs into the 90s?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really good point. I see guys today that have to design to make their, like you said, their shareholders or their investors, or, you know, they're about the dollar. So, you know, it's a tougher thing when you see what the trend is out there and people are just kind of following those trends because they're reading some algorithm and they heard from upper management, hey, you know, tie-dye is trending this year and you got to do this.
We're going to be print, a bit street or, and a bit cool now. That's always the best thing on board. How do we make this cool?
Right. And I will say that, you know, it was a big detriment to kind of, you know, people in my circle and friends that I know that were creatives, is they were just too early. And imagine, you know, my brother done well with his brand, but, you know, he was kind of my idol. You know, I watched him develop a brand, and it was around his lifestyle, but it was too early. And that's almost a detriment because he was designing whatever he wanted. He didn't have people in a room telling him, hey, you got to design this or that. He designed what he wanted and people gravitated towards it. But I think it was just, you know, 5-10 years too early. There was no Instagram at the time. But, you know, it, when it started to come about, it wasn't our focus. But you could see, definitely see people are, you know, everybody's a designer these days. Everybody's a photographer these days. And not taking away from that, because I like people who are really taking an interest in these things. But, you know, there's some guys out there that they live this, you know, they paved the way for several years, and their aesthetic is, you know, their lifestyle. It's a true lifestyle. They live it. It's not like they're making a line about road bikes and then they don't have a road bike or road bike themselves, right? So
do you road bike, by the way? The second time you mentioned that today.
Oh, yeah. You know,
I've been, like, Paul's converted to the road bike as well, I hear.
Yeah, I will tell you this. I've been shopping for a road bike. I've been riding a couple different bikes from friends, but I haven't purchased my own quite yet. But, you know, I've been really, since our podcast, and this is kind of odd, but, you know, when you guys did film the the trip for the Tribute 3705, I told the team, I said, hey, why don't we wait and shoot? You guys want to shoot this in December? We should try to do this in January because I'm going on a diet in January. And they said, well, what are you? I said, I'm starting to ride the bike. I made this whole regiment. And they're like,
you're
no,
be
Brian.
Grumpy. You're going to be grumpy if you're on a diet. That doesn't work.
Exactly. But since then, check this out. I mean, I lost 48 pounds since January. 48 pounds. And that's been me riding the bike hour and a half every day, 22 miles, boxing 3-4 days. I've been just putting myself through it, especially every time I see that video. I'm like, oh, I got to work harder now.
Oh, come on. You look fantastic.
Yeah.
But where are you going on the bike? 22 miles a day.
Oh, you know what? That is pure training. I've been using the Peloton.
Oh, the Peloton.
We have a local riverbed down by us. And yeah, you know, I mean, but it's you know, putting myself through training. You know, I feel the best I've ever felt in years.
Yeah. I mean, buying a bike, I think, is a seriously daunting undertaking because, you know, I was, before I converted sort of to road biking, I was mainly outside of skiing in summer, I was mainly a runner. And if you're a runner and you go to a specialist sort of sneaker store that actually does the running shoes, they will put you on a treadmill, they'll analyze you for 15 minutes, and then typically they're going to give you one or two shoes and say, well, that's the one for you. And job done. And maybe if you're lucky, you can decide whether it's going to be lime green or bright orange, but that's the end of it, right? So I expected the same thing when it came to road bikes. And the first time I had sort of my ideas and, okay, we're going to do this race. And I actually walked into our local bike store here that was recommended by Fabian Cancellara at the time. He goes to them and I turned up there and I said, okay, so, you know, fit me a bike. And they were like, well, what do you want? I said, I have no idea. I said, well, there's 15,365 frame types. You know, they come with 9.5 million different combinations of like components and stuff.
Seriously.
And we can fit everything to you. It just really depends on what you prefer. And I was like, oh my God, here we go. This is a whole different exercise. So then I think for my first bike, I spent probably the best part of 7 months. I had a design concept in my head. I wanted something to look like the original titanium Aquatimer from 2004 with the yellow accents and the black rubber strap and a titanium split minute. And then I tried to puzzle a bike together based on Peter Sagan frame on S-Works that I found limited edition. And I tried to build this up so it's all color matching and it really captures that code. And it actually meant in the end that my poor bike shop here had to set up a dealership entity in France to order certain components from Mavic and so on. So it's quite the process in the end, I must say. But so I understand why you've maybe been shying away from that one so far.
And you know, I got friends that ride quite often and they've been riding and they're like, hey, you should be riding vintage. And then I said, well, I kind of want this new S-Works thing. I need all the help I could get. And they're like, no, you're more of a vintage. And I said, you know what? This is like, the choices have just been, it's been crazy. And it's not, you know, it's not $100 either, right?
No, so. Not at all. So we've been working with this Swiss athlete for a while called Patrick Seabase. He's sort of a Red Bull athlete and he rides fixie bikes, you know, so the bikes that are single gear.
Yeah, so I have one as well. Yeah
and no brakes. The difference is obviously he rides that up and down the Swiss mountain passes and all of these crazy roads that are half snow covered. And he literally only brakes by sort of power sliding the whole bike sideways. So I'm like, okay.
That's a workout. That's a workout.
It is a workout indeed. So we have to discover some riding spots in and around your area at some point because literally I think my dear team in LA, I think they've taken me up somewhere in Beverly Hills once, like a cul-de-sac up a residential street and back down again. But that wasn't really the experience I was hoping for. So
we've got to improve on that. We got great roads here for sure.
So tell us a bit about your latest project. So you're opening a store up in LA, you said.
How are you
pushing the envelope? What's going on?
Yeah, we have our second kind of flagship door in Playa Vista in Los Angeles. Super excited. I mean, it's been, you know, because of what's happening with the ports, et cetera, we're still waiting on kind of all our fixtures at the moment. We should have been open weeks ago, but...
Yep. Welcome to the club. We had that with our Zurich Racing Works. Yeah, we tried to get the millwork from Italy and at the height of coronavirus. You can imagine what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, our little zone where we're in is called Free Market, and we're surrounded by great boutiques and kind of restaurants, and we're just in great company. And they're all, I mean, the gentleman who was in charge of the development is a good friend, is also a car guy and just a guy in fashion and lifestyle. So we're just honored to be welcome there. And kind of we have a great neighbor. So connecting to our door, there's the full bar, kind of speakeasy vibe. You can have a drink there. And we have a coffee shop and full cafe. That's our neighbor connecting to our store. So we're excited to be able to just offer more amenities and more service, but we're excited to show you guys what's on display and the new collections that we're designing for the space. We're excited. You know, I didn't think during this time, especially COVID times, to open a second door, but sometimes those opportunities find you. And I'm just thankful to God that we're able to have this opportunity. And
definitely.
Yeah, and I mean,
your space in Costa Mesa is absolutely stunning. It's a Thank real street font studio that looks a little bit like sort of workshop meets collector's cabinet, I'd call it probably. You know, you've got cars in there, you've got your apparel, you've got all sorts of memorabilia, but all done in a very, very sleek design conscious way. And that's is a new space a little bit similar, or are you going slightly different direction?
Yeah, it's a little bit different than that. It has obviously some of the same cues. I tied it in a bit, but you know, what was exciting was designing this kind of on a budget and thinking about how I can, you know, curate the space with a certain kind of, when there's restriction, you know, when there is no restriction. I never had that opportunity that when someone said, hey, open wallet, design whatever you want. And I've always kind of designed in those parameters. So it was really exciting to say, okay, look at the space, how I'm going to lay it out. But I'm always about the shell, how the floor is, the walls. I mean, it just today with it, with no furniture in it. I mean, our developer just did a wonderful job and it looks like a gallery already. So it's like I like it as is, bare.
Sometimes less is more. I think that's it, you know. Right? I've just had Hayden Cox on the podcast a little while ago. He has this surfboard brand in Sydney, Australia, and he's been working with people like Daniel Arsham now on collaborations. He's doing really well, and he's branched out to the US, and he's opened just around the corner from the Mattel Design Center in El Segundo. And he's had the same issue. He's kind of went in there and they did the sort of the raw concrete fixtures and, you know, floor and ceilings and so on, and then he kind of got stuck due to COVID. And it's the same thing. He's got a kind of very pure gallery space at the moment, soon exactly. to be completed, but sometimes you do wonder then whether you actually like it sort of half finished.
Exactly.
Well, we wish you good luck with that one. I'm sure it's going to be amazing, and it's also going to be exciting. So you have proper sort of catering and cafe right in front of you, you said.
Yeah, I mean, you could come over there. We're going to have host events there, and you know, with our brand collaborations, a lot of them will be launched there, so that we can just have a great, it's just got a great vibe to it. I mean, that whole little center where we're in, I mean, it's got, there's so much energy in there right now. So I really like it. It's something different for us. It's not a street facing store, so you got to go into our plaza to find us. But I think it'll be a great surprise for everyone when they come to visit. We're excited for it. Yeah, middle of June.
Oh, cool. We're just about to open our first cafe now. We're working on in South Korea, actually, in Seoul. So that's going to be exciting. We have a bar. I mean, we have a bar in Geneva that's been going for quite a number of years that we operate together with a partner. But now we're working with Center Coffee, and we're putting an IWC cafe into the heart of the men's luxury area, sort of the fashion area in Avenue L Shopping Mall. It's just going to be on a different level from our new sort of big duplex flagship store we're opening there. And that's exciting as well, because I think always how you extend a brand identity into a hospitality concept without that becoming a shop, but still kind of being a meaningful extension to the brand, that's hospitality is a difficult one, I must say. I've always found that there's some really, really peculiar things then. You know, I think my first ever design project in Switzerland was a what they called an ice cream gallery by a Swiss ice cream brand. And the idea was kind of to elevate kind of the scoopy ice cream game, you know, from sort of supermarket floor to something a little bit more elaborate. But very quickly, you find out that, you know, in F&B, there are some fundamentals about sort of density and presentation of food that you just can't ignore. You know, often when you see sort of fashion brand or car brand collaboration hospitality concepts, they're trying to turn this around into sort of their usual environment and sort of ignoring the fact that people want to see food that looks yummy, essentially, and that is appealing right. and inviting. And it's not a fashion store. It's not an art gallery and sort of, you know, 2.5 bits of pastry line up on a marble plate doesn't really cut it in F&B. So that you learn that quite quickly. You know, there's some fundamentals which you just can't ignore in that business. But I'm excited and definitely sure. excited to see your new space. So Brian, I've got a couple of final questions I want to ask you. So I'm curious because you obviously, you know, you had quite a journey so far already and you are very, very busy with what you're doing at the moment. But if you could go back and, you know, so you're talking to your younger self and you could give yourself one piece of advice you would have been grateful for back in the day when you started out, what would that be?
That's a good question. I do think if I was to tell my younger self, would to be to just kind of enjoy the moment, you know? I've worked my whole life kind of pushing and just grinding and trying to get to that next level for myself. And, you know, just you look back at it after 20 something years and you're like, wow, where did it go? I mean, I did enjoy those times, but it seems like, you know, for a good example, you know, our home, my home has kind of been my biggest project with my wife and we've been working on it for 14 years. And it's like, we're always pushing to like get to the next place or the next destination. And I just feel like I would have told myself, you know, just enjoy it while you're there. And we try to balance that now. You learn that as you get older. But just enjoying the journey, trying to enjoy every single moment is key.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you could have stopped time at any moment there, I mean, you talked about it just now, you know, some things just haven't been an absolute blur, but what is the kind of moment where you wish you'd had more time?
I think while the kids were super young, I mean, during those times, you know, my brother had us on a pretty strict travel schedule. You know, we had an office in Barcelona in Spain. We had an office in Montreal. We had an office in New York. We were in Tokyo and Hong Kong 3 times a year. I was, I don't want to say I was gone. I was home a lot, obviously, but I was also on travel a bit. So I feel like, you know, some of my two younger ones, you know, I was kind of busy during those days trying to build a base for us. So, I think if I could go back and I still remember, like, man, it's kind of a blur sometimes when I think about them being 3 or 4, like where did that time go, or 5?
Yeah. Well, I think it's generally super difficult to remember. Like I find it, you know, probably the mums on the podcast are going to kill me now, but I do find it hard to kind of think back and imagine my kids when they were younger compared to what they are now. And sometimes when I look at photos, it's like, my wife always says to me, but surely you remember when she was 2? And I was like, it's actually, like, I see them as they are now, and it's quite difficult for me to backtrack. I can see baby, but sometimes on the way, it's like not so clear anymore. And obviously, I've been extremely lucky here with our youngest, because literally she just turned 2 when COVID hit, more or less. And obviously, that grounded me completely. And I think, you know, created a completely different rhythm for our family, with me being there much more regularly. And I think that's also the first time that I kind of realized what I probably missed with the older ones, as you describe, because you are trying to do everything at once. You try and build, you know, a career for your family and all the rest of it. And it is a massive difference that, you know, you can see how much the kids feed off that regular presence in their lives, and the you know, not just the, you know, a single adult being the main educator and somebody else sort of popping in and out and sort of saying hi and bringing the teddy bears kind of thing. You know, there's definitely something to that. And I think we've been very lucky with the youngest one that we've had this time now where I could be around a bit more regularly. But let's have a quick look at your wrist history, and I want to connect this in your case, obviously, with your car history. So, first watch you remember and first car you remember. Well, you will first remember your first car.
First watch is definitely was a Swatch. You know, I was, you know, I've always considered myself kind of a collector. I've collected stamps and comic books and basketball cards and, you know, all the way up from shoes. And but Swatch was my first kind of love for watches, all the accessories, the guards. I mean, I made my folks drive us almost. I made them drive from L.A. all the way to Vancouver to the expo in the 80s because Swatch had this giant, I think it was like 50 foot display. It was a giant Swatch watch and you walked inside of it and they had a display of like their entire offering. And we drove all the way there. We camped in four different places. It was memorable. And I was, you know, I've had maybe 15 or 20 Swatches.
Wow.
So I used to line them up and that's kind of, it's, you know, a problem because it was the same way with me playing with robots or cars or Tamiya race RCs. I used to line them up. I can't have one. And, you know, I admire those guys that have the one in, one out rule. I don't.
Yeah. I know somebody like that. This is for me also as a collector is extremely difficult to manage. I think I do like an aesthetic standard and a consistency and a system in collecting for sure. But this one in, one out thing doesn't work for me either.
Yeah. Seriously.
But yeah, I remember my first Swatch actually was an all clear plastic Swatch. You know, we had the clear case and the clear strap on that. And I remember in those days, actually, my mum and all her friends, they all had these pop Swatches, you know, that oversized things.
Yeah, exactly.
On the stretchy bands, you know, that was all out 80s. And I remember this had a car story attached to it because just when those became hot in Europe or in Germany more precisely back in those days, it was the Peugeot 205 GTI, the black one with the red cheat lines and stuff.
Yes.
That was the absolute car to have back in those days, definitely, for the city commute at least. Powerful, that thing as well.
Yeah. And the car for me, you know, that started it for me, and I'll be honest, was, you know, I mean, I'll tell you one thing, you know, I've grown up just, you know, being kind of infatuated with cars since I was four. You know, my mom would take me to car shows or dealerships, and my poster in my bedroom was a Porsche Turbo. I had the F40 poster.
Yeah,
but,
I think
you know,
I had that one.
Yeah, I had 118 in the Countach. We had the white Countach poster as well, but I had a whole white, you know, I still have a photo of the room, which I could share one of these days. It's a bunch of 118 scale that my father had bought from Ferraris to Porsches, BMWs. And, you know, when it came time to kind of buy my first, I wouldn't say classic, this was in 2005. It was an E30 M3 BMW.
Wow.
And I went to a dealership local to me. They had three on a lot. Imagine three of them.
Yeah.
Wow. And the guy was an enthusiast. So he had a bunch of junk cars everywhere. And he had these three, one with the S14 all original stock. He said that was 7,000. Then he had another one with the S52 engine from an E36 M3.
Yeah.
That was 11,000. And then he had one for 17,000. I ended up buying the first one I ever bought for 5,500.
Wow. That's a solid investment, probably.
Yeah. I still have it today. And I ended up buying the second one, the one with the S52 motor in it. I regretly sold it, but I sold it to a good friend who still has it. So I'm happy about that. But that car did it for me. The lines and watching, you know, old video of it in the DTM races. I mean, that's when I discovered also the 190, and the 190 followed after that. I bought a 2316 Cosworth, and, you know, my wife drove it during our early days of marriage. She was like, so I'm driving this, and she, you know, she loved driving, you know, a manual, which was nice.
Yeah.
But, those were two of my first earlier cars. And I remember during those times, I was only buying cars under 10 grand. That was my budget.
Well, you could also buy houses for 25 back in those days.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, nobody took me to car shows aged four, but what I did do is I think I often stayed with a a babysitter of mine during the day because my mom studied law, still full-time when I was little, and they lived on a really busy road that came down the hill towards Frankfurt. And I used to stand by the fence and just endlessly sort of recite the car brands of everything that was going past. You know?
Oh, insane. The
same and this lady way. Was always like, "You weird."
I will say in my neighborhood, it's definitely not upper class. It was a middle class area in the city of Cerritos, California. But believe it or not, you know, six houses down, it was a good friend of my father who lived there, and he had a Ferrari 328. And then around the corner was another neighbor who had a 512 Testarossa and a Mondial Ferrari. So I used to skateboard there, watch them back up, ask them if I could wash it. They'd let me sit in it. So I kind of got, and you know, I was like 8, 9 years old, 10 years old, and they still had them, you know, till I left my mom's house. And so that helped. Watching
and then young
go
Brian
by.
Lost control over his skateboard and he skidded off and bang into that pristine paintwork of the Testarossa.
Exactly. That's another one. I had a picture of myself leaning on a 512 TR at a show in Beverly Hills that my mom brought me to. And I think I was 9. And, you know, I ended up buying the exact car in that photo and I drove it to my mom's house and literally she cried when she saw it because she has the photo in her room and she go and I'm holding my wallet on that photo. I could it still have that photo today. And she said, "You bought the car." And I said, "Yeah, I told you one day, you know, with the Lord's help, I'll own this car." And she cried and we shared a moment. Unfortunately, I did let that one go and replaced it with a couple different other Ferraris there. But yeah, I mean, that was a touchy moment. Yeah. It's kind of, right.
See, my real bad sort of, want moment in the sort of performance car world came quite a few years later, actually, because that was actually for me, really the proper starting point, I think, of the Mercedes journey when it came to me was when I joined IWC back in 2006, I wasn't even here for like a day or two when suddenly the gentleman who managed the Middle Eastern region suddenly turned up behind my desk, introduced himself, said, "Hi, Chris, my name is Chris. When are you going to Abu Dhabi?" And I was like, "Oh, I have no idea." You know, I think I was probably broadly knew where Abu Dhabi was on the map, but that's about as far as my knowledge extended. So apparently we were doing this first boutique in Abu Dhabi in a place called Marina Mall. And literally 2 days later, I was on a plane off to Dubai, again transferred to Abu Dhabi, and I met our local manager there, and we actually looked at this site for, which was a container shoebox boutique, which is going to sit in one of the corridors of Marina Mall as a sort of add-on to their to their shopping offer. It's ridiculous, you know, sort of, I think it's still there actually. It's a 6 meter side, you know, 36 square meter sort of glass box that would sit in the middle of this mall. And opposite that location was a place called Emirates Motorcars, and they're basically, I think, the official Merc and AMG distributor in Abu Dhabi.
Wow.
And back in those days, you could walk in there, so obviously this massive showroom. And the difference was, compared to anything I was used to in Europe, that all these cars were open and unlocked and you could sort of sit in them and nobody would say anything. So they had all the McLaren SLRs and all the stuff that was around back in 2006. And the one car that really caught my attention over anything else, and they had the jacked up G-classes and all of that, but the one car that I really clicked with was that CLK 63. In silver, in the safety car silver with the 20 spoke wheels, and then the ones that had the bucket seat and like the carbon fiber door linings that just had the embossed AMG, you know, the lightweight version, and that black series CLK 63. And I just thought there and then, this for me was the absolute perfect balance of performance but a really understated exterior, because it's not a shouty car, it hasn't got a great big wing on the back or anything like that, but I just this DTM look. And I think I agree with you there. I also, as a child, I clicked very heavily with a sort of touring car look. It's all a bit sort of wider, a bit lower to the ground, a bit aero, but not over the top. And then that's really, I mean, this car, and I thought one day CLK Black Series. That's and it's still on my list.
That's still on my list. That's still on my list too, Chris.
Still working
on my list. Yeah.
And I think you probably have more examples in California. I mean, the worst was, I think, when I lived in the UK and I started going on Auto Trader for these cars, and you realize, I don't know, I think they brought about 40 of those to the UK. That was it. So you literally cannot buy them. Whereas obviously here, Germany, Switzerland, the selection is a little bit better. But anyway, we're massively digressing.
Yes.
No, listen, Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on. We could talk for hours, and I'm sure we will again very soon.
Yes.
I can't wait to see a new place in Playa Vista and, you know, have a little bit of a bike off with you, with your new steely self.
Yes, let's do it.
We should definitely do that. Oh, brilliant. Thank you so much. Speak to you very soon. Thank you for being part of the podcast. Thank you to the audience for listening. You find Period Correct, of course, periodcorrect.com. Your Instagram is Period Correct. Am I correct, Brian?
Yes.
Correct.
Periodcorrect.com. You got it.
And Instagram is Period Correct. Of course, you'll find us at IWC Watches on Instagram, IWC.com. Of course, Chris Granger Howe on Instagram for all of those bits that we've been talking about. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Peace.